The following interview was recorded at the University of Vienna during the Very Large Database Conference in September of 2007.
So, good morning. My name is Ross King. I'm interviewing Professor Eric Brewer this morning. Dr. Brewer received his PhD from the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, is presently a professor of computer science at the University of California, Berkeley, one of the youngest tenured professors in history there, I believe, at the age of 32. And is presently taking leave of absence from there and acting as a director for the Intel Research Laboratory at Berkeley. Thank you for being here, Professor Brewer. I'd like to start the interview with a question regarding the topic of your keynote, which is your present passion of technology for developing regions. How did you become interested and involved in that particular issue?
Well, it kind of started actually in my days working with Inctomy Corporation. Inctomy was my first experience doing a lot of international travel and actually meeting really a very broad swath of people from all countries, particular at the World Economic Forum in Davos in the late 90s and around the year 2000. I was fortunate to meet many extremely creative and bright people from developing countries, particularly Africa and India. And they were quite not only passionate about their countries, but able to explain, I think, in ways I hadn't heard much before or since, really, about what some of the real problems are on the ground and what roles technology might play. So I think mostly out of the kind of general travel experience and realizing that, you know, technologists, roughly speaking, have been kind of ignoring most of the world for pretty much forever.
So we'll get to more on your central passion later. You just mentioned, of course, your very successful spin-off, Inctomy. I'd like to ask then what you would respond to a comment made by Dr. Fogels in his keynote yesterday, which is that the time to market from research to industry is too slow for industry. Can you confirm or deny this assertion?
Well, I think one way to think about that is maybe he's claiming that the current research focus is too short-term, where by short-term it means, by definition, that it's too close to what industry is doing now. I can say the work in developing regions does not have that problem. It's pretty clear. But I do worry about research in general. It's always easier to work on the problems that are close to industry, because they're clearer, unfortunately, I think, easier to get funding from all kinds of groups. So the system is pushing, I think, towards clearer, more predictable research, with the unfortunate side effect that it does tend to make it a little bit shorter term. Now, I think it's really only the internet industry, perhaps, that has quite the problem that he's talking about, at least the most severe version of it. But in general, I think it is, I think, time to push for a little bit longer research time horizon, which is mostly, I think, a funding issue and not a faculty issue. Mm-hmm.
And seeing as we are at the Very Large Database Conference, do you see a connection between emergent technologies and the VLDB, or is it just accident that you're giving your keynote here?
I think what I'm realizing, I think all the fields really of computer science have a role to play in developing regions, but it's fair to say that, you know, VLDB community is kind of in the middle in that time frame. The short-term things are really focused on, probably the community of, probably the best fit is actually the computer-human interaction. So, you know, like SIGCHI is a conference. Many of the issues they look at, such as user interactions, have immediate research problems in developing regions that are obvious to everyone in the community. Networking is probably also pretty obvious. There's lots of problems that need to be worked on that are under-addressed. In VLDB, it's less clear, but I think there are some places where there are research issues, particularly around moving from databases that are focused on consistency, the traditional metric of databases, to things that are more focused on availability and tolerating disconnection. And there's been some work on that, but I would say there's plenty more to do. And that's really a much more appropriate model for emerging regions, where you don't have good network connectivity, And you have a lot of mobile users that are doing record keeping currently on paper, but even if they did it on a computerized device, they'd still have a problem of updates at multiple locations that conflict. And there's plenty more to do in that kind of area.
One of the main focuses of your TIER project is providing rural connectivity. With that in mind, how do you see the internet as it is today as a resource for these developing communities in terms of education or information?
It's a tremendous resource. I think the most obvious and most important is actually simple communication. That's what's driven the cell phone revolution. Cell phones in Africa are incredible. That's the most impactful thing that's happened to Africa, arguably ever, with the possible exception of maybe colonialism, right? But it's on that scale. And even today, Africa is the fastest growing cellular market in the world by quite a bit. And the penetration is still relatively low at about 10-11%. So that's being driven by a basic need for communication. And just to give you an example, almost every small vendor has to have a phone now because it's how they find customers. Traditionally, vendors found customers by meeting them physically in a marketplace. And that means they have a very limited pool of customers. And what's happened essentially is that cell phones have allowed vendors to broaden their number of customers to, say, a radius, as opposed to the people they've actually physically bump into, which is simply too small a number. So it's been a big effect in Indian Africa, particularly for people that do unusual jobs like a locksmith or a taxi driver, where the number more customers they can reach, the more customers they have, the more income they make. So internet, I think above all, is really about just plain old communication. But to answer your question more directly, the second benefit is also quite important, which is that as an information repository. That one's a little bit trickier because there tends not to be enough local language content. And we're actually working on a couple things to fix that. So in India, it's not as bad because a significant amount of English speaking, but there's also a fair amount of content in Hindi, although there's less content in the other Indian languages. In Africa, it's much more complicated. There's, arguably 6,000 languages in Africa, most of which don't even have representation on a computer, let alone any content. And those are, I would say, probably hopeless. They'll likely die as a language before they get internet content. But there are a large number that do have representation. Representation is, some people means that you can represent it using Unicode. That's actually not sufficient, it turns out, for a variety of reasons. There's some nice work in India showing that if you want to have search engines work effectively, for example, then everyone has to use the same, not only the same Unicode, but the same subset of Unicode. Otherwise, the computer can't tell that two words are the same because they have different representations. So there's actually many complicated issues in internet content for languages other than English. And that definitely needs some work. Now, on top of that, how do you actually generate new local content is an open question. And I think we have some ideas there, but it's still wide open. The best way we've seen tends to be to get people to create content in a way that it stays around.
So, for example, using blogs or wikis or what's traditionally called Web 2.0 technology.
For example, IIT Bombay has a project called Aqua, which is essentially could be summarized as a decision support system that uses questions and answers. And the questions can be answered by other farmers or by experts. They have a panel of experts that know all kinds of agricultural topics like soil, diseases, things like that. So that actually is mixed language. I don't know how many languages are in it, but I've seen at least two or three. And so you can ask questions in your own language and get answers in your own language. And that content persists. So it's actually they're creating content in that way.
Once again, stressing the communication aspect of the technologies and how one can transfer and disseminate knowledge.
In Guinea-Bissau, we have a project that's using essentially disconnected database technology, although it's not it's disguised as a file system, but it's essentially database technology, to allow community radio stations to share interviews. So radio stations are another very good source of local content. So obviously, it's audio content, but it's at least in the local language. And if you can get some keywords in and index it a little bit, you start to build a repository of useful content. So we're doing that in Guinea-Bissau. We use the long-distance networks to actually connect the repositories. We're using kind of disconnected file system to actually share the data.
You've stressed in your talk that a central aspect of these projects is that they should actually be economically sustainable. They're not philanthropy. They're the so-called no-loss project or no-loss business. How do you beat what I would call the hamburger paradox? The hamburger paradox is the fact that there's a huge demand in the world for grain, but the fact that rich countries would prefer to have beef leads the grain to be fed to cows rather than to people. It seems we have the same problem with the lower tier of the pyramid, so to speak, in terms of technology. What are your thoughts in that direction?
Complicated question. So I would say historically we've built Western computer science around the personal computer. And it's pretty clear that's not the platform of choice for most developing countries. It'll be some variation of the cell phone. So the first disconnect is simply we tend to invest in PCs when we should be investing in cell phones as kind of what is the platform, what is the framework, what are the software tools, where do the databases run, for example. Do they run on cell phones or do they run on PCs? Do they run on servers? So this is just a general, I would say, disconnect on seeing what's being used versus what we're good at. And I would say we're good at servers and we're less good at distributed systems based on cell phones, which is really no work, very little work. So the good news is there's a huge opportunity for applications that can run even on regular cell phones using a normal keypad. You don't even necessarily need a real keyboard or a big screen. And these are the devices that people actually have. They're already socially accepted. They're fundamentally cheaper. They're fundamentally more rugged. They come with their own batteries, right? They have their own power source. They solve the power problem. So it is the right platform, but I would say the infrastructure for cellular applications is woefully lacking compared to the infrastructure for PC applications.
My question was probably a bit too general. Maybe I can specify it a little more by saying, what is Intel's interest in supporting this kind of program? How can you bring social conscience to a large company like Intel?
Well, Intel has multiple reasons to be interested in this kind of work. From the purely business side, if you look at Intel, it's already the case that most of its growth is coming in emerging regions. Now, to be fair, that's India and China, and to a lesser extent, Brazil and Russia, more so than, say, Africa. But, you know, any large Western technology company, I think it's pretty fair to say at this point, that the Western markets are becoming saturated. And that if you want to have a lot of growth, you're going to have to get that growth from a different population. And so I would say Intel's purely business interest in this work is how to accelerate the emergence of new customers, right?
And then we could apply the same question to the research community. You touched a little bit on this in the Q&A session. How can we encourage research publications, panels, and so forth to support research that's in the direction of emerging technologies and emerging regions?
It's a little tricky, and that's why I'm giving talks like this one, which is that I think the first issue is simply awareness that technology has a role to play, and awareness that the current system of top conferences and publications essentially determines what research can be done. And so if you want to open a new field, you have to make room for that field in prestigious conferences, because the best people need to be in prestigious conferences for their own career. It's as simple as that. So my hope is by a little bit of awareness and by asking the question that future reviewers, not only in VLDB, but in other computer science fields, will be more open-minded about looking at the value of work in developing countries. And the other problem, which is, I think, pretty fundamental, is that to do work in developing countries always requires, has two basic problems. One is that it requires a lot more engineering for how much for each application, essentially. All right. To get a telemedicine system in India, we also had to solve, you know, outdoor Linux routers and antenna alignment and power subsystems and training. Right. So you can't just work in your lab and get a paper out every quarter. Right. The people that work in this area will have fewer publications because there's more work for each publication. But I would argue that each of those publications will stand the test of time much more significantly.
And it has a huge impact on human lives, in fact.
More impact.
So as to wrap up the interview, then I'd like to ask if you have any particular advice or suggestions for young people studying computer science.
Well, I think the work we're doing in developing countries is certainly compelling to students. But I think it's a sign of something that's a little bit broader, which is that as computer science matures, it's really becoming a much more applied science that affects all aspects of life. So whether it's biology or social science or global warming or developing regions, all of these are fields where a computer background is important in the application context. And that's a shift for computer science. We've been quite introspective historically about how to make our own field better. And I think most of the value of computer science in the next century will be through its applications. And therefore, I'm expecting computer science departments, like it or not, to essentially have to expand to include more of these applications as part of what it means to be a computer scientist. So, you know, some of the problems that I'll run into is developing regions such as, you know, is this really a computer science problem or not? I think it's just indicative of the way the whole field will go over the next century, that all the interesting work will end up, not all, but a vast majority of impactful work will be the application of computer science to broad social issues.
That's excellent. Thank you very much. So good morning. My name is Ross King, and I'm here talking with Professor Michael Stonebreaker. He was a professor of computer science at UC Berkeley for 25 years, where he pioneered major work in the relational databases, starting with the Ingress and then later the object relational database Postgres implementations. He's presently an adjunct professor at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, and I'd like to, on behalf of the University of Vienna, welcome you here and thank you for taking part in this interview. The softball question. You spent 25 years in Berkeley and now you're on the East Coast. Have you suffered any particular culture shock?
the famous story, which isn't exactly true, is that my wife and I moved to the East Coast because I was interested in staying married and it was time to live where she wanted to live for a while. Since that time, you know, I think the East Coast has seasons. It has a lot more varied culture. It has green trees and it has much better access to recreation than the West Coast. So I actually think it's quite a nice place to live.
So we're here at the Very Large Database Conference. What is today a very large database, and how has that changed over the last 10 years?
I think the simple answer is that online transaction processing systems are not very big. The big ones are all data warehouses. And in a couple weeks, I'm going to a conference at the Stanford Linear Accelerator Center, and they are talking about 100 petabyte database. And so at the high end, you know, I wonder how long it's going to be before we start talking about exabytes. And so because the appetite for, you know, harnessing data for business intelligence and scientific purposes is essentially unbounded. So I think warehouses are going to grow without bound, over the foreseeable future, limited only by, you know, software's ability to manage it and people's appetite to, you know, throw low-cost disk technology at storing it.
I actually did my PhD at Stanford Linear Accelerator Center, which makes us traditional rivals, Stanford versus Berkeley. I noticed that you've just started a multi-author blog called the Database Column. What prompted that, and how do you see the function of blogs in the research community?
I think, you know, I find it really, really remarkable that there's this sea change taking place, which is it used to be that if you were a company, you wanted to get your message out, you went around and talked to journalists, and they interviewed you like we are talking now, and then they proceeded to take their interview notes and completely garble it and publish it in the trade rags. And also they would dumb it down completely to something they could understand. So I think the blogs completely eliminate the journalist in the middle and are simply a way for people to get out their message without this middleman screwing it up. And also they're two-way so that your competitors can comment on your blogs. You can comment on your competitors' blogs, and it gives much more technically accurate information from many more people without a journalist in the middle. So I think it's a fabulous way to interchange information, and it seems to be growing without bound. How did this get going? This is Vertica Marketing saying this is the way to get your message out. And I think it's becoming wildly more popular. And I think my speculation is that trade shows have largely fallen off as a way to get technical information. And I think the same thing is going to happen to the trade rags like Information Week and Computer World as blogs take
or
over.
Conferences as well, perhaps.
I think it's already the case that technical papers that anyone wants to read are available over the web. You come to conferences to rub shoulders with your colleagues, and that it's the social aspect that will not get replaced by the internet.
In your first blog entry, you basically disparage the one-size-fits-all approach of the large database vendors, or elephants, as you referred to them in your keynote. Also, Dr. Fogels, in his keynote, referred to the one-size-fits-all problem. Was that the result of collaboration or discussion, or is that convergence on a clear problem?
No collaboration. Other than one of the co-authors on our work is Pat Helland, who used to work at Amazon, now works at Microsoft. I've never talked to Werner about these issues. Werner is an example of a high-end customer with very demanding problems, who is badly served by the current one-size-fits-all solutions. So I think he's just typical of the other the demanding problems among the web companies. I mean, they are running into horrible scale problems, and that he's just exemplary of that community of folks. And I would be surprised if he ever said he was happy with the elephant's performance.
So one of your central theses is that the relational data model has forced us into a kind of path dependency where we're in a dead end now. I see a parallel between this and the QWERTY style keyboard. This keyboard was originally driven by mechanical considerations and later was maintained because operators knew how to use it, just as your present day database gurus know how to twiddle the knobs on the big systems. Given this problem, we still use QWERTY keyboards today. How are we going to get industries to move away from their major investment in database systems to the more performant customized solutions?
Okay, so I think there are three answers to that question. The first answer is it's a plausible future scenario that the current user interface SQL will continue indefinitely, and that faster engines that are vertical market specialized will simply be underneath the sheets, and that you will replace this one-size-fits-all monolith with several compatible but specialized engines, and the user interface won't change. So that's one possible scenario. I think that's that's likely in the short run. I wonder what will happen in the medium to long run. The second thing is that, as Mr. Brody, who comes next, will be happy to tell you, the big investment in current database systems is the skill to run them, DBAs. And if you can figure out how to morph the programs without a lot of human intervention, and if you have a different operational interface that is vastly easier to use, people will move to it instantly to save DBA time and money. So I think the operational interface to database systems has to get way easier to use, because every company I talk to is dying under inability to hire enough good DBAs and the cost of paying them. So I think the second answer is that people will move to solutions that are simpler if there's an ROI that saves them money. The third answer about the QWERTY keyboard is, I think there are huge counterexamples to that. Look at just the proliferation of little languages, Perl, Python, Ruby, .. which are getting adopted, are incredibly popular. It used to be said that you couldn't possibly introduce a new language because programmers knew C++, and that was it. And so Java, little languages, Ajax, web programming is all, a complete paradigm shift. So there are lots of examples of paradigm shifts. So I think it's not, if there's an interesting ROI, it's possible. There will be no paradigm shift without an interesting ROI.
However, this last point, the proliferation of small languages, gives perhaps hope regarding your first point, that we don't have to remain based on SQL interfaces and can have actually embedded access directly to the data layer.
Ruby on Rails is proving to be violently popular, and it is not the same user interface. It is not SQL. It's an embedded entity relationship language embedded into Ruby. So, it's a straight counterexample to you can't change the user interface, and it's very, very popular. And I think the other thing is that I think you should keep in mind is that in the web world, it's mostly greenfield applications, which it's new stuff people are building. I think, the legacy will continue to exist in its current form for a long, long time, but that doesn't say you can't build new stuff in some different way.
You've had astounding and perhaps even unparalleled success in spinning off commercial companies from your research. So how would you reply to the charge that the time to market from research to industry is too slow, as we heard from Mr. Vogels yesterday?
I think I would make the statement even stronger, which is that the large IT companies in general do not innovate. They innovate at such a slow rate that I think you might as well say they don't innovate. And what seems to happen is that innovation occurs in startups, and then the elephants either buy them or get threatened, or like Google, you continue an independent life. So I think the technology transfer is occurring through startups. It's not occurring by large companies making investments in new stuff. They're just way too conservative. So I think the startup market is alive and well and is the only interesting path to get new ideas into the marketplace. So if you have a new idea, I would encourage you to go solicit venture capital and commercialize it, through the venture capital route, rather than try and get one of the elephants interested.
So you find...
And I think the time to market for VC-backed ventures is going to zero. I say the delay is going to zero.
And the VC market, clearly there's been a change since the crash around 2000, 2001, but it's still alive and kicking in your experience.
Well, my experience, and I think this is a, you know, a country by country statement. In the U.S., the venture capital community is awash in money, and any good idea can get funded. And the so I think there's more funding than there are good ideas to fund in the U.S. And I think the problem I keep hearing from European researchers is that they can't get European money. And what seems to be happening is that the American VCs are coming to Europe, you know, to, you know, pick in search of new ideas. And so I think if European venture capital doesn't work, the American VC community will fill that need. So I think, I basically view it that there's plenty of capital, and the return on investment in the venture capital community is still good enough that there's plenty of money and will be for the foreseeable future. And if you have a good idea, the worst that can happen is that you can go to the U.S. and get it funded.
So to end our discussion, then I'd like to ask if you have any specific advice to young people starting to study computer sciences, particularly in Europe.
Well, I think I'd make two kinds of comments. The first comment is there's a fabulous book called The World is Flat by Thomas Friedman. I would highly recommend everybody read that book, because I think we're moving to a time where there's a single worldwide IT market, and that will over time mean that the wages worldwide in IT are going to move toward leveling, presumably to the disadvantage of the US and Europe. But I think in the short run, you know, if you're a computer scientist, learning Chinese would be an awfully good idea. Because there's no question that offshoring is going to increasingly happen. So anyway, number one, pay attention to it's a global economy. Number two, I think the only reason the U.S. stays ahead is because of the path between research, technological innovation, startups is so short. And so if Europe wants to really make itself known, figure out how to shorten that for European ideas, because you guys have plenty of ideas, you just don't seem to be able to get a path to get them commercialized. I'm befuddled why that is so hard for you guys to solve. So anyway, solve that problem. But that doesn't really answer the question, which is what should a student study? I actually am vaguely cynical in the following sense, which is I think it's entirely possible that we will look back in 25 years to the current time as the golden age of computer science. And it's entirely possible that the future will be, less robust than what we enjoy right now. Because, relative to other scientific disciplines, we are very, very well paid. We're treated very well. We're allowed to dress however we want. And I'm not sure that will continue. So I'm especially not sure that wages will continue to go up. So I'm not, I'm not convinced that computer science will be the fabulous career discipline over the next generation that it has been for our generation. On the other hand, I'm hard-pressed to think of anything better. And so I think, that it's always said that the bio guys, have the inside track for the next generation. But every bio guy I talk to says that the demand for bio jobs, that the supply exceeds demand, and that that isn't such a great career right now. So I think computer science will be good. The best you can do is be interdisciplinary enough to know some other problem domain. I mean, bioinformatics will be good. I mean, pick your favorite application area and know about it, plus computer science. And the web is obviously taking over the world. And so knowing the web well will serve people well. So that's kind of a long-winded answer.
Thank you very much, Professor Stonebreaker. So good morning. I'm Ross King, and I'm here interviewing Dr. Michael Brody. Dr. Brody earned his PhD at the University of Toronto, has spent years in both academia and industry, and is presently the chief scientist at Verizon Communications. On behalf of the University of Vienna, I'd like to welcome you and thank you for taking part in this interview. Dr. Brody, we're here at the Very Large Database Conference. What, in your opinion, is a large database today, and how has this evolved over the last decade?
Well, as I said in my talk, the growth rates of databases are, if it's a large mission-critical database, they tend to grow by a factor of five about every 2 years. And if it's a smaller database back office, it grows a factor of two over, say, 2 or 3 years. But so the growth rate is enormous. Those numbers sound small, but the growth rates are enormous because the base is large. We have large data warehouses, and I don't know the size of the largest warehouses, but an OLTP system we have, because I watch it quite closely, is in excess of 50 terabytes online operational data store. That number, by the way, was the last time I looked, was November, so presumably it's considerably bigger. So in our business, terabyte databases are certainly commonplace. But as I showed in my slides, depending on the nature of the business, astrophysics, weather, population databases, they get into the petabyte range.
Now, Dr. Stonebreaker, in his industry talk and in previous interview, has more or less suggested that relational databases don't do anything particularly well, and that they should be discarded in favor of streamlined, customized solutions. How realistic is this for a large company like Verizon that maybe has tens of thousands of databases?
Well, let me start with a little anecdote, and that is, do you remember the death of the mainframe? Well, when there is a large, extremely well-established infrastructure like the QWERTY keyboard, it doesn't go away overnight. In fact, it may never go away. I project that relational databases are here probably forever. And however, as I predicted in my talk, there will be all kinds of special purpose stores, as Mike was saying in his keynote, and these will begin to proliferate precisely for the reason Mike mentioned in his interview, which is ROI. If it's too expensive to store data in these large, overly complex stores, and it's costly to run them because of the manual overhead of DBAs, companies are simply going to go away from it. So there will be new systems going away from relational databases. Now let's get back to the hard part of the question. And that is, we have a vast amount of not only relational, but IMS and other databases running our business. Our business relies on it. And I can assure you that one, I'm sort of on vacation here in Europe. Back at home, one of the biggest efforts in the company at this moment is to look at our databases to determine precisely how can we get away from these monsters. And they're monsters in the following sense. Most of the large relational data stores have of the order of 150 knobs, options, whatever you want to call them, each very complicated to manage in and of themselves, let alone how they interact. And we don't have super genius DBAs for every application. Look at the numbers I told you, over 8,000 systems.
Even if you could find them, you couldn't afford them because the human resources is a major part of the investment in the whole system.
If you've noticed, in most major corporations, the budget for IT does not increase, it decreases. So the question is, how do you maintain massive data stores when the actual budget for doing so decreases every single year? I mean, there are budget increases for new systems, but not for the legacy running systems. So we have looked very deeply into this business of migrating systems. And I can assure you from, a book that Mike Stonebreaker and I wrote, Migrating Legacy Systems. That book was written in about 1995, and it remains true today. And the answer is, it is massively difficult. There are tools that are supported by the vendors like Microsoft and Oracle and IBM that can essentially migrate your system. Around 85 to 90% of it can be done, you know, just like that. But that's volume and that's data. It has nothing to do with migrating the stack on top, and all of the cost resides there. So a much more effective method of eliminating or migrating away from a particular data store, either to another relational one, for example, open source, is to kill the application and migrate the data into a similar application. So it's a data consolidation through applications where you don't have to play with the application layer, which is where all the cost in migration resides.
On the other hand, in your talk, you introduced the concept of the information fabric, which, as I understood it, is a kind of middleware layer that would serve to integrate these disparate systems. Is that what you meant? Is it middleware? Is it more? And what is the more?
Well, the name middleware came about in the mid-90s to say it's somewhere between the application and the iron. And sure, that's where it lives. But I actually believe that we are now going to look at layers of computation. And so the purpose of the information fabric is not simply a layer to encapsulate data. It is a means by which service-oriented applications access data at the service in terms of services. So there's much more to it. But if you saw the diagram, it just looks like a distributed database we all know and love. And indeed, one of the leading experts in distributed query, Mike Carey, developed such a tool at BEA called Aqualogic Data Services Platform. And I am told by Forrester that there are several major financial companies in New York that can't wait for the IBMs and Oracles to come out with products to do this in 2 years, 3 years, and they're beginning to compose their own. So there's much more to this layer than simply a screen, because the typical things one wants to do with data is not just query and access. You want to update too. So we all know that from databases. But there's all sorts of other things you need to do, such as complex security constraints, contextual aspects of modifying queries, ETL, that is translating of data, because the requesting application requires the data in a much different format than it is elsewhere. There is semantic integrate. We're going to come to that, I hope. So there's many, many things that we do in applications. Let's go back to the previous question. The reason these applications are so difficult to migrate in the current legacy world is the applications themselves incorporate those things. The idea in the new, what I call computer science 2.0, is to extract those functions from applications and put them as services. Now, isn't that how databases were invented in the first place? People were writing applications, and they're doing all this data management in their applications against the file. Hey, why don't we take those functions out and create a database system that'll do it for all apps? Well, the same is true now of most of these functions, such as security, translation, data quality management, service level agreement management, and so forth. So it's, yes, it looks like a nice simple diagram. I was trying to use the simplicity to get the idea across, but it's much more complex.
And in particular, you opened up my next question, which is what would be the role of semantic technologies in the information fabric?
In the good old days, over the last few decades, people would hear the word semantics and say, oh, that's AI. It doesn't work and never work, unless you're an AI, in which case you're having a lot of fun. The issue is very simple. The number of objects one needs to manage is going to increase beyond the ability of human labor to manage it. Simply, software is going to have to manage data. Oh, and that was the layering thing I was mentioning before. Infrastructure is going to have to recompose and manage itself. I mentioned that databases are going to have to be self-managing. So is ETL, so is security. All of these things are going to have to be self-managing.
Hence the importance of semantic web service descriptions.
Right. So let's put away AI for the moment and just say, in order for things to be self-managing, they have to be described in such a way that two interacting entities need to be able to access each other, determine whether they are the appropriate things to interact, do some handshaking to make sure they can interact, do the interaction, all without human intervention. So, you know, ER model didn't work too well in terms of expressiveness. SQL doesn't work all that well in terms of expressiveness. And some of the early languages were certainly second order and non-computable. So what we've been doing in the semantic technologies community is trying to, first of all, solve the problem with things like OWL, which of course is second order and non-computable. And so now we have OWL as an ontology. What's an ontology? Mapping tool. So we have this non-computable mapping tool, and what the semantic community has done very effectively over the past 4 or 5 years is reduced it to subsets of OWL and even smaller subsets that are somewhat domain-specific to do certain types of reasoning to facilitate just the kind of mappings that we need. Now, I have to say there's no silver bullet, absolutely no silver bullet. Metadata is hard. We don't have great solutions, but I don't see another alternative. And I think the semantic technologies community is being highly funded by research organizations, and IBM, SAP, and Oracle and BEA have all announced that they're supporting RDF to some degree and some amount of OWL. And I believe that the door is opening to experimentation as to how are we going to deal with the scale. So it's not a simple thing. And that's why semantic technologies has an opportunity, because we need to program at a much higher level than we're programming now.
Please excuse me. This begs a question that I didn't have prepared, but is there still a role for semantics for the end user? Or is the end user never going to understand anything more than a simple free text search?
Well, thank you for that great question. The end user should never see any plumbing. And semantics, why should they ever see what semantics? I mean, he's an accountant solving a financial problem. He's an engineer. He's a DNA scientist looking for mappings. These things should be all entirely invisible to any of the users. We're at VLDB. It's a plumbing conference. And the only people who should care about plumbing are the people who need a new toilet. Right? And you know, you want to just be able to use it simply and solve the problem that you've bought it for. So semantics, ontologies have always been frightening to many people because it's, what the heck is it? It's way too complex. Sure, let's get domain experts to develop ontologies for finance, for engineering, for bio, for physics, for astrophysics, for whatever it is. Get those communities to develop solutions and provide what we should provide our end users, which are problem-solving environments.
I'll shift the tone a little bit now. On your personal webpage, you pose an interesting question. You state, whatever you're doing with computers, you're changing the world. Is it for the better? This begs a question that I also asked Professor Brewer before. How can you bring a social conscience into your role as a computer scientist or at a large company like Verizon?
Well, I'll give you a little history. I went to university to join the ministry. So I have a previous career. So it gives you some idea of the kinds of things that may have led to the question.
Sorry, you said that didn't come up in my background research, nor your connection with Dr. Stonebreaker. Sorry about that.
Okay, so one day I was sitting at my desk at then GTE, a former the forerunner of Verizon, and I was thinking about my commitment to my values. And I was wondering, what do I do when I sit here every day writing programs, writing projects, thinking in computer science? And I asked myself the question. And then I said, I have an opportunity, because I was going to give a keynote at AAAI, which in fact we had 3,000 people at my talk. A little daunting. And so I don't know the answer, because the answer, I can tell you my personal answer, but it's a little personal. But the issue is not for me to answer this question for others, but to pose them the question, which is why that question came from my talk, which went a little bit like this. I was talking about AI and databases at AAAI. I got to the last slide, and up comes Mother Teresa as a picture. And people are thinking, what's going to happen now? And I said, Mother Teresa has changed the world through simple actions, through her own commitment, through things that were available around her. So I ask you, how can you change the world? What are your values? And is what you're doing with this interview or what you're going to do with your studies, are they going to change the world? So it's a very personal question about values and your ability to connect to the world around you. And you should be aware of the potential impact of what you're doing, not at the day-to-day level, which you should be, but at the larger level. Is this the right thing you should be doing in your career? So I think all young students should be asking themselves this, you know, not where's the money, not where's the fun, which is great questions, but, you know, what's going on in the world? And is there something I personally can do to just move it forward a bit?
So far, I've ended all my interviews with the question, what would you like to offer to students of computer science? But I think you've already answered it. So I'll say, unless you would like to add something else.
Well, let me just say the same thing that Mike Stonebreaker said, and that is about interdisciplinary things. What has happened historically in most of universities, research, is people go deeper and deeper and deeper. Oh, let me give you an example of tunnel vision. So I went to, shall we not name the vendor, but it's one of three vendors of databases, and I gave a talk on the use of databases in Verizon. And so I asked a question, because this particular vendor had about 140 options available in their system. So I had about 200 people in the audience, and by a show of hands, I said, how many people understand blah, blah, blah?
Knob two.
A couple of hands go up. How many people understand knob three? A couple of hands go up. There was one, Dieter Gawick, who has a good view of, a good friend of mine has a great breadth of understanding of the architecture, and his hand went up about five or six times out of 20 questions. So, now that's a computing artifact, but the question is people need to understand not just the depth of something, because you need that in order to provide value, but you also need to understand how things relate to one another. So let me put in a plug for Web Sciences, which is an idea of Tim Berners-Lee, Wendy Hall, Nigel Shadbolt, Danny Weitzner, Ben Schneiderman, that are promoting the notion that there is an intimate interaction between technology, distributed systems in general, and society. And what is that connection? How do things come about? How does one influence the other? So this is a wonderful outcome of the challenges the net has posed. So my advice is go deep to get skills, but always be aware of a broader spectrum, which is related to the previous answer I gave.
Thank you very much.